You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back for part two of my conversation with Taylor Mack. I'm Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That. It's the podcast where you can, on the Broadway Podcast Network. If you're enjoying the conversation, visit me at bpn.com/youcantsaythat for more interesting conversations with my peers. You've done a lot of Brecht.
No, just The Good Prison of Szechuan.
Just Szechuan, and you didn't write that. You were just acting in that, right?
I was just acting in it. I didn't do the translation. But I like just acting sometimes. It's really nice. It's so, like, easy. It's so easy. It's so much less work than producing, directing, acting, writing, you know. Like, that's what I usually do. And everyone always says, oh, no, you shouldn't act in your own work or you shouldn't write and act at the same time, you know. Let someone else do that so you can be an outside eye and look. And I said, no. That's bullshit. Like, just, you know, do your work and work how hard you want to work and figure it out, and everyone adapts to the new techniques that need to be used, and it's fine. It always works out. But ever so often, I just, like, focus on one thing.
See, we're at the opposite ends of that pendulum.
Oh, really?
Like, I look at you and I think, I don't know how anybody could do a 24-hour musical. I saw 12 hours of it, and I was just like...
You could do it.
I don't even want to do a solo show, okay? I'm like, that shit is hard. But at the same time, as an actor, it's no longer enough. Like, it's just too easy. It's like, I can do most of the things people offer me in my sleep. I'm like, why should I get out of bed and go spend 6 hours a day? Like, I can do this today.
Right.
You know? But for you, you need a break from the fact that you're firing on all cylinders all the time.
Yeah.
For me, I'm looking for moments where I can fire on all cylinders.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know?
Well, that was a decision I made early on, is that I have such respect for actors that just commit to the material. Don't judge it. Don't judge the character. They just are full on in it, and they do that thing. I knew I was never going to be that actor. I always want to work with actors like that, but I knew I was never going to be that actor. That I couldn't just get up and do something that I didn't politically agree with or socially agree with. And so I have things to say. So I knew I had to make some kind of hybrid work for myself, because I wasn't going to be happy doing under fives on Law & Order. I just wasn't going to be happy convincing the world that every defendant is guilty. I just couldn't do it.
Right.
So, and most of the people I know who have those kind of careers, they're not happy. So, and they're extraordinary actors who are just, you know. So anyways, I try to encourage people who have some kind of drive to make their own work. I don't know.
You should
make your own work. I want to see your work.
I kind of try sometimes. Like, I was interviewing Bridget Everett the
other day. She was in my first musical that I wrote.
She changed my life. Like, was doing our hit parade was life altering for me.
Oh, wow.
I told her that I saw her perform once, and she ended a song by sitting on a patron's face.
Yeah.
And
I've seen
it
that.
Fucked with me in such a way that I left the theater. I didn't say goodbye. I just fled home. I didn't know what it had done to me. I had no words for the experience. It just fucked with me. And when I ran into her many months later and she asked me to come on stage with her, I was like, I need to see what you do. And then when I saw our hit parade, I was blown away. And she was like, you don't have to do all that. You can just sing a song. And I was like, oh, no. If I'm coming here, I want
to
meet what these people are doing.
And figure this out.
I ended up doing Blow Me One Last Kiss. Brian Nash arranged it. We made it this whole Catholicism thing. And I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So it was this confrontation of Catholicism. I was in a nun's habit. I had the Cat of Nine Tails. I was beating myself for saying these swear words. We went into this exorcist thing. And then, you know, it ended and I had like a dildo underneath my habit. And leading up to it, I cried and cried.
Because you were nervous? Or
I expected God to strike me down dead or to strike my children down dead. I thought that I would be punished for this sacrilegious event. And you know, my friend was like, why are you doing this thing? This you're so upset about it. Why would you do something? I said, because it's so fucking scary to me that I can't live with this fear. Yeah. This fear is crippling me. And so I went and did it. It went by so fast.
Oh, I love
and then
that
I waited
feeling,
to
though.
Die. And I didn't. I was like, oh, shit, there's a whole... It was like it suddenly opened a whole door that I didn't know was closed until I did the thing that I would never do.
Yeah. When I was first doing my performance art, and it was the scariest thing ever to stand up there wearing, like, newspapers that I'd glued to my half-naked body and singing these original songs and dealing with the audience and the improv of that and not being an improv artist, having no craft of it and going in and just trying to be brave and doing something outside of what I was trained to do, which is this very traditional neoliberal theater, you know? I'll never go back, really. I mean, I'll dabble in the neoliberal. I mean, it's fun, you know, I enjoy it, but I just never go back. It's so liberating. It's so scary. That first time is scary. Yeah. Oh, I hope you'll do more. It sounds wonderful.
Well, it excites me. The feeling of it for me was kind of an adrenaline. I only want to do things that scare me that much.
Yeah. So like, would you think to do a whole thing at Joe's Pub or someplace like
I've
that?
I've done like 15 nightclub acts.
Uh-huh.
And they have been wild and crazy stuff. Like I write them and they're crazy. Yeah. And, you know, I have guys dressed up in heels singing. I bring a Sibian on stage and have people on Sibian. I mean, I've done some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I think the thing that deterred me from that is doing it all by myself and not having any producer. And that when they call me, you go, there's like 2 seats sold. And you're like, oh God, I got to try to get people in. I was like, that part did not interest me.
Yeah. Well, that's, you got to be a self.
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. How do you do that? What is that self-promotion thing? I do not understand the self-promotion thing.
Well, you know
thing.
This wonderful, Christy Edmonds, who's, she runs the UCLA performing, the Center of the Art of Performance in Los Angeles. And she's extraordinary. And she booked me, and Royce Hall. It's a big theater out there. And I'd never performed in LA before. And so I said, you know, this theater is too big for me for my first time. And she said, Taylor, if we rely on the artist to get the audience, we're not doing our job. And it was the first time anyone had ever said that to me in the presenting world. I'd always carried this burden of it's my responsibility to bring in the audience.
Yes.
And what she was saying is, no, that's our job. Your job is to make the art. And it was so liberating to me because now I don't really worry about it. It is the theater's job. That's why they get paid salaries. We don't get paid salaries unless we're like working 8 days a week. We don't get paid a salary. So it's their job to do that. So I would say the activism in that fear of, you know, if they're only 2 people bought tickets, that is the pub's problem. That is not your problem. And so then the responsibility has to be put on. Then you have to find the venue who's actually going to hold their responsibility and live up to it, you know, to get you an audience.
I like that as an idea because it just exhausted me. I loved the performing, but the trying to get an audience and the posters and the placards and the this and the that. And it's like you still like...
But I don't believe that you perform in New York City and only 2 people show up.
No,
I don't
two
believe
is hyperbolic.
Right.
Okay. But, you know, you think the room is only 120 people and I can't sell out 120 people?
Right, I know. It's like, depressing when you can't. And it's so interesting because 1 year you'll be like, packed. Every show's
one
packed.
One year's packed.
And then the next year it's like, nope.
Nope. And you have no idea why. And you're like, oh, nothing's because changed. I was in this thing and they're thinking about me. And also New York has so much choice.
So many choices.
So much choice. Yeah. Like people could be... And people could just stay home and watch TV, really.
Well, and it's
right
also
now.
About, I mean, it's about getting the, it is about getting the word out. I mean, that the advertising only, you know, at a 180 seat theater or whatever isn't going to be, there's not going to be a big budget for it.
Right.
So, you know, that is tricky. I find that ritual helps. I find when you
do ritual?
Ritual performance in terms of booking one show sometimes will not get you an audience, but booking 30 shows over the course of 8 months will get you an audience. And what I mean by that is...
But who's going to book you 30 times if you can't get an audience the first time?
Well, you get an audience... Like, basically, this word of mouth is part of that. You know, you start to build this word of mouth, the same show. Like, Bridget will do the same show for a couple years.
Yes.
Right? At Joe's Pub, night after night after night after night. Now, she's famous at this point, but she wasn't.
Right.
And when we were doing 24 Decade, we started and I would have, you know, 100 people in a 180 seat house. And then word got out. And then eventually it was packed every time. So
I got to just keep doing it.
Well, I mean, I think that there's something to the opera. Well, the burlesque performers are my friend Dirty Martini. She makes her fan dance, right? Mm. She does one number. It's the fan dance. And she was doing it in 1999 or 2000 when I first encountered her, and she's still doing it. And I always felt I've sung that song. And the audience they've seen it, so I can't do that again. And I learned from the burlesque performers, no, just keep doing. You can do different numbers as well, but just keep doing it. And I've seen over the years how she's built an audience through the repetition. It's just like the freaking politicians who repeat the same slogan time after time. I mean, it is making a commodity out of the performance.
Right. No.
So that's, you know, cheap. But
no, for me, it's like I'm bored. Like I've explored this song 12 times. I don't want to sing it anymore. Like
really?
That's what it is for me. It's like people always want me to sing the songs for my shows. I'm like, oh, I know you like that. I don't want to sing
that song.
Yeah, and I did again, the hyperbole. 8 shows a week.
Yeah, you did it 8 times a week for 2 years or
no, a year. That was the longest I've ever done anything.
But that's a lot of shows.
I know.
That's like, more than 12 times.
I sang it enough times. I got to sing it again.
I know,
but
no wonder you're bored,
because,
you know,
but I think that's like a thing that children have. Like, they want to hear the same story again. Mm. And you could read it to them 5 times, and they really like it. My poor children, their mother would not do that for them. Their mother would like, no.
I think 300 performances is enough. Like, you can let it go after that. But
I think people want to see your signature song. Like, people are always asking me to sing Lot's Wife. Like, nah, not going to happen.
Yeah. You've moved on. Yeah. I think you should.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it, but yeah.
Yeah.
It took. It was like a piece of life.
Yeah. What do you want to, if you were to do another musical, what do you want to do? People ask you that all the time.
No, people don't ask me that all the time.
Is there anything in the canon that you're like, I want to do that role?
No, because I think in the cabaret, I picked all the songs out of the canon and I sang them.
Yeah.
And I think I always picked my work based on who was in the room.
Yeah.
So I didn't read the material. I would just be like, oh, they're in the room? Oh, I just want to be in a room with them.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it didn't matter what the material was, or if the material was up to worthy. It was like, well, we're going to be in the room. we're going to make it better. Like, we're going to be there. And I feel like in that, it was that year of Mother Courage, there were like 3 shows that I was in the room with really great people.
Uh-huh.
And it was 3 in a row, which was the 3 strikes and I was out, where my intelligence and inquisitiveness was not matched in the room and was in fact treated like it was a problem.
Yeah.
That I wanted to go deeper, that I wanted to know more, and it was like, that was a problem. And I was like, that's all I do. Mm-hmm. I come in the room and I'm like, okay, we figured that out. Now what else? Yeah. What else? It's like, George has this thing. He says, brilliance lies in the moment that might not work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah, this thing that has never existed before.
And that's where he exists too. That's the fun part of George, is that's where he exists. Is like, I mean, it's the danger of George, but it's also the fun part of it.
But that's what, and I've worked with him more than anyone in my career. So that's where I live. I'm like, okay, we figured out all these things that do work. Now, what are we going to try that might not work? That might be some shit that nobody's ever seen before. That's where I want to be.
Yeah.
And I just, stopped meeting people in the room who were working at that level.
Yeah. Well, it would be hard to start with. I mean, not that you started with him, but your first Broadway musical was with George, right?
No. Oh, my first Broadway musical was Mary Riley, We Roll Along.
Was it
really?
Prince
and Steve Sondheim.
Well, okay. So Sondheim and then George Wolfe. So, I mean, you know, I mean, it's hard to, those are very smart people. It's hard to go from them to somebody who's like, meh, meh.
Yeah, it is hard. I've worked with the greatest artists of my time.
Yeah.
And I'm accustomed to like being in a room and telling Tony Kushner that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So if Tony Kushner can hear that from me, you new playwright, you can't hear me tell you that doesn't work.
Yeah,
you gonna be mad at me? Come on now.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know what to say to that.
But for me, that's the excitement, like that friction of, okay, you, and then, like for me, that's like sex. For me, mm-hmm. like when we are working creatively at our best, it's the friction of like, well, I like this. And then suddenly, combustion happens and something has come into being from this friction of the two things. And now there's something that didn't exist before.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like everybody's so cozy and comfy.
I think I might be one of those cozy people you're complaining about.
I don't think you are. There's nothing I've seen you do that was cozy and comfy. And I saw somewhere where you said you build in failure into the work.
I
you
do.
Build in the potential.
Yeah, that's like the baby. Like I wanted like the potential for the ending of the play, which we're so used to being so perfectly like crafted, and the ending of the play could ruin the entire experience, but then elevate the experience because the experience is the art that's in the room, not your preconceived notion of what you've just experienced. You know, so. To me, that's exciting, the danger in the room. Can you give over the dramatic event, the moment when everything changes, can you give that over to the audience and how they respond each night differently? That, to me, is thrilling, and it takes us away from epiphany. And it brings back the liveness of theater instead of, one of the reasons you get tired of singing the song every single night is because of the concept of that weird thing that happens on Broadway or even in regional theater where they freeze the show. That's why Bridget's so exciting. You know, when you go and say, you saw our hit parade, everything was alive in the moment. Everything could be different because there's no freezing the show. And that, it's my least favorite thing to hear is the show frozen. I'm always like, fuck you. Like, no,
right.
It's alive. And I'm trying to make moments that are alive for the audience so that they can feel alive in their considerations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what made Whitney Houston exciting. You could go hear her sing the same song. It was not ever going to be the way it was on the record.
Yes.
She was going to do some new stuff, and you were there to be in her exploring it in a new way every night. And when I did Caroline in London, Matt Lowe, the music director, said to me, it's just so fascinating to me how you do a different show every night. The lines are the same, and the music is the same, and the blocking is the same, but you do a different performance every night. I can't have that. He said, I've got to put together 12 companies and they've got to be the same.
Oh,
I was like, oh. I said, so you were like responsible for the standardization of musical theater into McDonald's and Starbucks because I'm like, musical theater is one-offs. Ethel Merman, these people who were just iconic. There isn't another one.
Yeah.
That's what musical theater is. Yeah, I don't have to change the lines, the blocking, or the words to actually let you experience the life of it in a different way every night.
Yeah.
And we've sort of suddenly moved away from that. And that's from a music director who runs a lot of big shows all over the world. That is seen as a threat to commerce.
Yeah.
Because people want to know that if their friends told them about it in New York, that when they go to see it in London, it's going to be the same show.
They saw that exact same thing. It's like eating at McDonald's in Rome.
Oh, my God. Like, who wants that?
A lot of people.
I know.
You know, but so Dan Fish said to me, the most wonderful thing was, so he does this Oklahoma, and And the people that love it, and the people that hate it are mad that it's not Oklahoma, their version of Oklahoma, right? And he says, I always thought the point of theater was that the curtain goes up and you don't know what's on the other side. But people come to the theater because they want to know what's on the other side. Even that the marketing for, Nathan would always talk about this, the marketing for Mamma Mia, their poster said, you already know you love it. Which is like,
you already know
that is
love
evil
it.
To me. I mean, I get that some people like that, but for me, it's just that's no, you shouldn't already know if you love it. It shouldn't be. Where's the surprise?
Yeah, I guess a lot of people don't want surprise.
They don't. They want to know what they want what they know, and that's not what I'm. That's not my genre.
Arts, and it's not what the arts. To me, the arts is not, that's not our purpose. We rev up our society. We point a finger at what the problem is. We show that. And that's why it's so radical. And that's why countries shut down the artists and kill them first.
Well, people have done, I mean, it's the difference between something that's artistic and something that's art, right? So like everything that's on Broadway is artistic. Everything, even the most commodified piece of Disney or whatever is artistic, but it's not art. And the difference, you know, is...
Art is dangerous.
Art is dangerous. Art is going to break up the status quo, not support it.
Right.
I mean, and the early theater, it all came from... I mean, the Sanskrit plays and the Greeks, they were all about... shoring up the status quo, making sure everybody adheres to the kind of social dictate and honors the king and the queen and the emperor and the church and the, you know, all of that and the rules and stuff. So they were all kind of about teaching people how to behave in the world, so it's rooted in us, but part of our job is to break free of that, because that's just artistic. That's not art. That's propaganda, actually.
It is propaganda. And so much of our movies and our television is propaganda.
Yeah.
And it's great propaganda. And it is beautiful propaganda.
It's entertaining. I love it.
It works. Like, for me, I've been loving Korean drama. Do you watch any Korean drama?
No, but I saw that Parasite movie. It's wonderful. Oh, it's so good.
What I love about the Koreans is that they don't follow Aristotelian three-act structure.
Uh-huh.
And they just mix genres, and there are no rules. And it's just like, you're just on a ride, and you just go, hybrid. And it works. And I mean, that Parasite starts as a comedy, and then it's a drama, and then it's a tragedy, and then it's a farce, and then it's a horror, and then it's like fucking an epic Greek tragedy.
I mean, it's everything that I want my theater to be. And so in even the liveness feels present. You actually don't know what's going to happen, because he's making hybrid work. He's squishing all of those genres and forms and styles all together in the same film. So you're not sure. You're always surprised by everything, the reaction. He's juggling tropes, and at the same time he's breaking them. It's so beautifully done. And
agreed.
And it's not homogenous. You know, you don't feel like you're seeing the same thing you've seen 5 million times.
I'm grateful for you making what you make. No, I really, really am, because I also think it paints this path for other artists to follow in. Do you know what I mean? So it's interesting to me that you, like, do you know Hannah Gadsby too? Hannah Gadsby, the Australian.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm
comedian.
Excited by people like you and Hannah and Bridget, who are making art of your uniqueness, art that nobody else could make it.
Yeah.
Like, it is the expression of you in the world.
I don't know what to say to that, but I guess I'm trying. Maybe I'm a little insecure about that, because I feel that identity is subplot, but when it's plot, it's less interesting.
What do you mean by identity as plot? No, I want to know.
Well, I guess I mean that 24 decade history of popular music is, people often say, it's a queer retelling of American history. And I'm like, no. The queer aspect of it is the subplot. It is essentially like everything, because I'm queer and I'm on stage and I'm telling it, the history is queer, right?
Okay.
Because it's coming from a queer body, the history is queer.
Okay.
And that's important, and I want it to be there. It's who I am. But the show itself is about how communities are built because they're while they're being torn apart. The questions that emerge as a result of that phenomenon of communities being built because they're torn apart, and queerness and queer communities are certainly an aspect of that history. Wow.
Somebody's
excited.
I don't know what it is. Somebody's screaming it for somebody down there.
Yeah.
I don't think of your work as queer. So yeah. When I think but I'm going to see why. Taylor Mack, I'm not like, oh, I'm going to see this queer artist. I'm like, I'm going to see a Taylor Mack. And yeah. Whatever point of view is going to come out is going to be something that is uniquely how Taylor experiences and reprocesses the world and gives it back to us. You know, when I think of Bridget, I just am going to see Bridget Everett, and she's going to do some shit that only Bridget experiences. Same with Hannah Gadsby. I mean, you know, Hannah just discovered she was autistic. So it's like, I don't think I'm going to see this autistic person.
No.
For me, it's that this could only come from this that Martha Graham to Agnes DeMille quote, like, if you don't express it, it will not exist anywhere else in the world, and that's your obligation.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like, okay, well, you might not be queer in a few years. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm not trying to examine your identity.
I'm interested
in what's coming through you, and however that evolves over the course of your life, I'm interested because it's exciting and engaging and entertaining as well. So I'm on the journey with you, however you evolve through your life.
Yeah. Well, and I think maybe the reason why when you go to see me, you don't think I'm going to see this queer performer is because the queerness is the reference for contextualization, but it's not the point.
Right.
So it's maybe how things are interpreted, but it's not the point of the work. So it's not the point. It's subtext of the work, you know. So I guess that's really what I mean. I guess where the insecurity comes from is how does the individual escape ego and still make work? That's really my question, you know.
Yeah, and ego is a big part of work.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like when I do make work, I just made my first feature film.
Oh, you did?
I wrote it, produced it, directed, starred in it. Social political horror. And
you like horror movies.
I love horror movies. And I think the ego place in it is like, you know, there would be points when you know, my team would be like, well, this is what's on the page. And I'm like, uh-huh. And this is what we're going to do right now. Because I'm seeing, and I realized, like, there's things that they're reading on the page in a linear way, and I know what that means, and I don't have time to explain to you because right now I got to make something right here because I can see.
And you want
all
people
that
who will just commit,
right?
I
they got to just
when
commit.
People just commit.
I can't explain it to you. I don't have time. I can be done with it before I try to explain to you why it's not doesn't look like what you see on the page or what you understand what it's on the page to be.
Nigel Smith is directing my new play that's going to be at the Fleet, and he was saying to the actors, I just want you all to commit to every moment, whatever it might be. Like, that's all you need to do. You don't need to wonder if what the psychology is behind it. Just commit. And that was for young performers. That's a note for young performers.
And see, I'm the teacher who tells my young performers, now you got to understand everything. You are the material. You are the actor. They are coming to see you. You know, because I'm upset with that. I go to actors and I go, so what was it like being in the room? Like, what was the conversation? What are you making? And they'll be like,
They
just showing up to be paper dolls, and I can't be a paper doll.
I know it goes back to our thing.
I can't be your paper doll.
I can't just do that job.
I want to understand because my mind is going to be working.
Yeah.
So,
you know, the more that you make your own thing, the more at least
the more
this
it's
has
a
been
relief
my experience.
To be a paper doll. You're like,
it is a
I
relief
to
be a paper doll. You just show up and do the thing and have some fun. I've just been offered this role on Broadway, which, you know, if it works out with the schedule, I'm going to do. Part of me was like, okay, well, I got to engage. And of course they've asked me to be in it so that I will engage mentally and stuff. And there's this other part of me that was just like, or I could just play the part.
Yeah.
I could just, how much fun would that be? Just show up and play the part for,
I get know. That. Yeah. I totally get that. And I've tried it. Mm-hmm. Like, I think my attitude about doing television was like, hey, I am totally a paper doll in television because I don't know how the director's going to edit it. I don't know what the vision is. There's a whole bunch of people who are in control and I don't know. So I just show up to be the material that they're going to use. Mm-hmm. And then I got sort of wrestled into doing this nothing part, mm-hmm. where literally they asked me to come in and they said, we just need her strength in the room. It's kind of just to be an extra. And I was like, it was a lot of money to be an extra.
Well, all right. Then
an extra? Yeah, sure. I came in one time. I thought one time. Then it became two times. Mm-hmm. Then it became, I was the titular character on the show, but I was just
sitting there in the background. Extra.
And literally an extra. And I might have one line. And so, you know, and then it would be like, could you just do less? Could you just do less? I'm like, no, I can't be invisible. Okay, I'm not able to be invisible. I don't even speak like, in the scene.
I didn't become a performer so I could be invisible.
You know, but it started to be a kind of grating thing for me because, like, right. I don't even do anything in the yeah, thing. Yeah. And I had a director. It was actually a very kind thing. She said to me, she said, you know, Tanya, I'm sorry I keep asking you to do less. She said, you're just so commanding on screen that I can't take my eyes off you. And it's just not your movie.
Well, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. But, you know, I always think, like, if you get cast to play Scout or whatever that character's name that plays the wall in Midsummer Night Dream, and somebody asks you, what's the play about? Well, it's about this guy who plays a wall.
That's what it is to be an artist. That's what Bill Esper used to say. He said, you know an actor when you go, so what's the play about? Well, it's about this wall.
It's about this wall.
Exactly. That is what it is to be
because
an artist.
That's the actor's job, the director's job, and the playwright's job is to think about the themes and the ideas. And sure, the actor needs to think about the themes and ideas of the big play as a wall. But it's still about the wall.
That's your entry point, is you're the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And my gift as an actor is I have always had the view of the director. I didn't mm-hmm. know that until now. Mm. So I've never been one of those actors who could just go in and just try to make it about me and make me. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to serve the vision of the playwright and the director.
Yeah.
So I wanted to understand what is the big thing we're building. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to craft my thing so that each piece of it is leading to the thing you're trying to make because
right.
I'm seeing that mm-hmm. that yeah. is my way in is understanding that, oh, we get to hear. So, you know, here's the moment where I need to be hated. And then here's the moment where I win yeah. you back. And cause I do think of myself as a craftsperson. So,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, I'm from my point of view, but I also see that I fit into something bigger
uh-huh.
and I actually feel like I have the control and the craft to be able to plot the points that are building this thing that you are building, even when you don't know it, because my being inside of it and knowing it, I just do know those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I long for both, you know, whenever I'm working with actors, I long for the actor who's going to make 5 million choices and come at it from the perspective that they're the lead, even if they're the smallest part. And I long for the person who understands that that they're not the lead, even if they are the lead, that the play is the lead, that the ideas are the lead, that that what we're trying to all collectively do together is bigger than us as individuals. So, you know, you want to like juggle both of those things. And yeah. That's the dream collaboration.
You need all of that in the room. Like George yeah. says, the best ensemble is a group of stars.
Mm.
He says, because you want the audience to be able to look anywhere on the stage at any moment in time and see something exciting. And he says, if you have a bunch of stars on stage, everybody knows if you don't take the moment, I will. So, you know, everybody is just stepping up, stepping up, stepping up.
Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, Suf's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Yeah. That's not how I would want to work.
Because tell us why. Tell me why. Because maybe star means something to you than it means to me, though.
Yeah.
So star to me doesn't have to do with your name fame. Right. To me, star is that everybody is like at the top of their game. Yeah. Nobody may think of them as a star, but the quality of their work is like they can come. They have the ability to say, I dare you to turn away from me.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I love being challenged in the room. But you know what I'm more interested in is being inspired.
And what inspires?
So something like Tigger, who's a burlesque performer, one of the first burlesque performers in the neo burlesque movement. He helped create burlesque. He's extraordinary. And he's a muse of mine, and I cast him in almost everything I do. And I like Tigger doesn't challenge me. Like, he'll take a moment, you know. If he comes on stage, you know he's going to make a choice. All eyes are going to be on him when he walks in. He's going to fill every moment, and every moment is going to be full until he leaves the stage. And I don't feel threatened by that. I feel inspired to step up, but I also feel inspired to make space for that, right? So what happens is he'll walk on stage and I'll be singing a song, and then I want to, oh, somebody made a choice. Let me give them space. Hello, yes, parade, do your thing. And now it's my turn again, you know? I guess I feel... It's more of semantics. It's more the framing.
I think it is semantic because I think we agree. Because I remember once I was doing Caroline in London, and I was doing something, and all of a sudden I was like, "What's going on? What's going on here?" Mm-hmm. And I turned around, and I was like, "What are you all doing back here?" And this woman, one of the actors, said, "Oh, I was trying to give you your moment." I was trying to like do nothing, so to give you, and I was like. Honey, first of all, I don't need you to give me a moment.
I can take the moment.
I can take the moment. And if I can't take it, then please take it. But don't try to be nothing. Because I could feel the vacuousness. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I could feel the lack of what was going on. In her trying to give me something, she actually distracted me from the fact that there was nothing happening here that was weird.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was just a... I don't know actually what she was doing, but I knew that it was calling my attention even though she was behind me.
That's so strange. That is a weird thing.
It is a weird thing.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, I just always find that when you make space for other people, you end up making space for yourself ultimately as well. Mm. So I kind of... that's just my philosophy. I just don't like that. I don't really like to frame it like a competition, you know?
I don't
like,
think of it as a competition. Yeah. But I think when I'm working with someone who is good or better than me, I don't have to do any work. I literally just get on stage and I just pay attention to them and respond. Yeah. And it is like sex. Yeah, it's like if someone's good, you just pay attention and you just respond to that. Uh-huh. And it's just like... This and amazing
it inspires
thing.
You to,
yes,
because yeah. I was definitely trained, and I love this philosophy that the other person on the stage, and I think of this as the audience sometimes too, is your life jacket, that you rely on that person, And there's no way to make the art without the other person. So everything has to come from the other person. It's very Meisner, you know?
It is. I was trained Meisner, too.
Yeah, yeah. Everything has to come from the other person.
Everything's the other person. And the better they are, the better you are.
The better you are.
You know? Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, that is my...
And I mean, it could be a semantics miscommunication about generosity, but that's what I think of generosity, is somebody, again, who's able to play that tennis with you, you know? That the tennis isn't about who gets to win the game, but when you get in that moment of we're hitting the ball back and forth, and it's so exciting. Oh,
it's like sex. It is like sex. I've experienced it maybe 4 times in my life. Mm. The last one was with Diane Wiest.
Really? Oh, she's so wonderful.
I don't think she even knows how wonderful she is. Like, she's one of those people who just, like, opens up a channel and lets some shit come through her. And she's a master class. So sometimes I would just have to just be marveling. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I she's such a private person. Like, I don't know what she thinks of me as a human being or anything like that. But to work with her, I learned so much. And I could tell that she respected me enough that she would start playing with me. Uh-huh. And she'd be like, okay, I'm going to do this. Uh-huh. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to do that. Oh. And then we would start, like, you know, and then sometimes we would just crack each other up in the middle of the stage because we had reached this point where we were just playing with our craft with each other, you know? Yeah. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. When Julie White came on board with Gary, I'm so freaking in love with her.
She's master.
She is master. And she would do that sometimes too, where I she had to learn her part in 4 days and stuff. So she attached to anything that she could in order to make it happen. And you could see that one of her goals was to make Nathan Lane laugh. And it was so alive to me. I mean, I think it annoyed George, but, you know, because he wanted them to be in the play and all this stuff. But for me, I just felt like, well, that is the play. That is the spirit of the play to a degree, is that you're marveling at this incredible character at the same time you're marveling at the person who is playing the character. That duality is fascinating to me. And that what always made it work for me, it was action. She was doing something. She wasn't just like making a joke. She was trying to do something to the other person on the stage. And that person, she relied on that person. And if they broke, ha 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 ha, like, then she's alive. You know, then she's in the character. And you would see the whole room transform when that happened, partially because they thought they were getting something original. And they were, because they did it in a different spot every night. But it was a trope. They would always do it.
Right.
You know, it was interesting to see them play and to see him try to resist, and then to see Christine, you know, her character really is trying to resist, and to see her ever so often, one night in particular, she couldn't hold it. I just loved it. I just think it's there's a preciousness about realism that always makes me feel like it's sitting on me, you know? I'm like, just let it go. We're all in the theater. We know we're in the theater. I know we're making magic, and we will, but you can make magic 1 second and everyone believes it and break the magic and it's a different kind of magic the next second. And then you can go back to making the magic that everyone believes the illusion in the next second. That's real craft, to be able to pop back and forth those two worlds and just commit. That to me is... it's heaven when I'm sitting in a theater. It's why I prefer musicals. Because in the musicals, they pop from different worlds nonstop. Sometimes you sing it, sometimes you're talking, sometimes you're dancing, sometimes, you know? And, you know, anyways.
Well, the last thing I'm going to ask you about is, because I could talk to you forever. You said something in the 12-hour, or the 24-hour musical, but the 12-hour musical, you said, it's okay for you to hate me, it's okay for you to be uncomfortable, to be aggravated, to want to leave. No matter what, in performance art, you can't fail.
Right, there's
and
no failure.
And you said that there's this wonderful way in which you always make your performances to design a little bit of failure, because that's the way in which you... you know, allow people to see your humanity.
I think there's a great deal to be said for and championed in terms of, I frame it like reaching for the hem of God, using your virtuosity, reaching for virtuosity and practicing and practicing and practicing and doing the thing that you're very good at. And reaching the hem of God is like, yes, I'm almost to God status because I'm almost not human anymore, because I'm so good, you know. So there's something to be said for that. That is the goal, right? We're going to lift ourselves up towards perfection, but there's something also that is undermined in the culture a lot, which Nina Simone had, which is that you are vulnerable enough to expose your humanity and to try to reach the people, you have to expose your humanity. So we're not reaching for this thing above us, but we're actually trying to reach each other. And you have to say, I'm broken. And here's my broken part. And what can we do with this broken part? Can we transform it? Do you have this broken part as well? And so that's something I'm always trying to ask myself in every piece. Dorothy Allison framed it a different way to her writing students. She would say, write the one thing about yourself that you don't want anyone to know. And then they would do that on a piece of paper in their secret little corner. And then she would say, that's the opening line of your new book. So you're risking, and I work that way a lot of the times. I'll say, I'm going to risk this thing I don't want anyone to know about me. I'm going to put that on stage first. That is going to be what the piece is about. And then you find your way to healing, but you also find your way to sharing your humanity with, I don't know, that there's reaching the people is just as important as inspiring the people to something greater.
I think I was raised in such a way where any mistake or error was punished so severely that my survival depended upon competence.
Yeah.
And knowing what I was doing, or at least doing whatever I was doing as if I knew it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't fully aware of that until I started taking clown work. You know, watching how the funny moment is the moment when the clown is like, doesn't know what's going to happen, doesn't it? And seeing how I had developed a lifelong habit of covering that so quickly that you never did, that moment of the funny would not be there because I could fill that up quick. And having to relax into allowing myself to be and not knowing out of a survival habit, you know what I mean? Because that's was where the funny is. And, you know, it's a place that I just continue to try to work into, you know.
Yeah.
But the habit is very strong.
What are the comedies that you've done? Have you done a lot of comedies?
No, I haven't done a lot of comedies. I had a teacher who told me I wasn't funny, so I didn't, you know, I believed that story for a long time. Well,
so
certainly
I always
Rashida
thought I
speaking.
Wasn't funny, too.
Rashida speaking, Play on Broadway. Those are probably really the only two times I've gotten to do anything comedic. And when I was young, I got to do stuff that was always about being the naive comedy person. I like to write comedy.
Was it fun for you to do those? Or
oh, I loved it. Yeah. I loved
making
it.
Making people laugh.
And I love for people to make fun of me.
Uh-huh.
Like, I love it. I think it's great when someone is, like, imitating me and making fun of me. I love to laugh at myself. Yeah, and I think more of the things that I do and write, even though they're dark, it's what's that apocryphal line? I think they attribute it to either Wilde or Molière, or maybe to both, but it's like, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or else they'll kill you.
You know? Well, that and the Buffons, which I find so fascinating, their whole technique is they want to make the audience laugh so hard they die. because they've been kicked out of the culture, and they find their way into the culture to perform for the court, and their whole goal is revolution by making the audience laugh so hard they die.
And what is this? How can I find this? I want to know about this. How do I find
the Buffons?
The Buffons? Is it a play?
It's just an old comedy. It's one of the comedy characters. You know, it's
like
the fool, the clown, the Buffon, the mime, and the Buffons, that they have a particular thing. They were the grotesque, who were not allowed in because they were deformed and they were gross. But every once a year, during the festival time, they let the Buffons in to perform for the people, and their revenge on them is we will make them laugh so hard they die. So it's vicious, but it's also wonderful.
I love this. I must explore this.
You should be a Buffon.
Oh my God, I love it.
Look up Red Bastard. He's one of the
Red
great Buffons
Bastard.
Right now.
I'm definitely doing that, because in my horror movie, you know, one of my delights in writing a horror movie is that I always have you having a really fun time laughing with someone just before a really brutal death.
Mm. Yes, please.
And that's what makes me happy.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so wonderful.
Yeah. Juxtaposition. You gotta have the tragedy with the comedy to make the comedy even funnier.
Yes.
You have to have a little tragedy at the end of the comedy in order to see the comedy.
Yes, it looks a lot funnier when you're down there.
Amazing.
Coming and talking to me, Taylor.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
It was good. That was great. I'm glad. This is Tanya Pinkins on You Can't Say That with my guest, Taylor Mack, on the Broadway Podcast Network.
Oh, I'm never working again.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That with Tanya Pinkins, part of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Dori Berenstein, edited by Alan Seals, with music by Anthony Norman. You can find more information and other great Broadway-related podcasts via broadwaypodcastnetwork.com/youcantsaythat.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.